Welcome, everyone. It is April 1st, and this is not an April Fool's joke. Brett Thomas here, one of the partners in Integral Publishers, and I am just so delighted for tonight's call, a topic that like many of, if not all of the folks listening in, either listening in live or listening to the recording afterwards, is very interested in the intersection between leadership, and in particular, integral leadership, as well as your unique self, this new idea and new kind of groundbreaking idea around life purpose and how life purpose is expressed in an awakened person and in an awakened mind and in an awakened self. And so we're going to have tonight Dr. Russ Volkman, who is the, as many of you know, the founder of Integral Leadership Review and my partner in Integral Publishers, as well as Dr. Mark Goffney, who, again, many of you also know as the author of the new book that came out recently, Your Unique Self. We're actually, Russ and I are on the line, and Dr. Mark Goffney is actually late, so I wanted to go ahead and get started, and I didn't want to keep you all on hold too long, let you know that we expect him to dial in any minute. I spoke to his assistant just a few minutes ago, so perhaps he's having phone trouble. But Russ, why don't you go ahead and say hello, and let's just take a minute or two while we're waiting for Mark to arrive to share with the group, one, why you chose to publish Your Unique Self, and two, why you're excited about this combination of Your Unique Self and how important it is to leadership. And you and I were talking before we started that I think that Unique Self is incredibly relevant and hugely additive to our understanding of leadership, and I'd love to hear your reflections as we, again, kind of waiting for Mark to arrive, which we expect him to arrive pretty soon.
Well, thank you, Brett. There is a complex set of reasons underlying why we chose to publish Unique Self. But one of the reasons is because I believe Mark has a unique voice and one that is integrally informed and that offers a lot for us to chew on. Some of the things that I'm inclined to say now maybe things that we'll have to go over again with Mark, but one of the things that I've seen in the integral movement for so many years is the focus on the individual, the focus on the self. And one of the reasons why I'm intrigued by the notion of leadership, as we can get into what I mean by that in a little bit, is that it's more than about the self. And I think Mark's approach to the unique self not only drills down into what it means to be human, what it means to be alive, what it means to express and understand and comprehend oneself in the world, but it is connected not just to the interiority of the individual, but to that world, to the life conditions, to the world around.
Hello, everyone.
And the system. Hey, Mark, I was just talking about you.
Awesome. I've been trying to get into the call for the last 5 minutes, and I just kept getting bounced out from the number. So I just got in, so I apologize.
That's all right. I was about to launch into a lecture.
Awesome. Take it away, Russ. Good to hear your voice, sir.
Good to hear you. Now, let's turn this back into a dialogue like it was intended to be.
Okay, so tell me where we are.
Well, Brett had asked me why I published Your Unique Self, why Integral Publishers decided to publish Your Unique Self. And essentially, I was putting all the blame on you.
Perfect. That's a great question. Hello, Brett.
Hello. We had really just started, and the initial frame was that I proposed, in my experience, you know, now for quite a long time working with leaders, I believe that that unique self, I mean, just the sense of life purpose in the first place is hugely important for leaders. But unique self, you know, takes the conversation about a person's purpose to a whole nother level, and it just seems incredibly relevant and incredibly additive to me to a conversation about leadership, you know, leadership phenomenon, the leader, each of us as we have an opportunity to step into leadership roles or leader activities. And so, so I'm just eager, as I know many of the listeners are, to hear y'all's reflections. So y'all can just kind of dive right in and take it any direction you want to take it.
Fantastic. Thank you, Russ, and thank you, Brett. And again, apologies to the listeners for being unable to quite get on the call. Sometimes we have these virtuous problems in the world of virtual, but here we are. Let me just suggest a couple of sentences of a frame from my perspective, Russ, and then pass it back to you.
Okay.
You know, in the leadership conversation that you're so involved with Integral Leadership Review, and, you know, and Brett, I know you guys are working on a great book, you know, about leadership, and last year you did the Integral Leadership Collaborative. And Brett, I don't know if Brett's told you this, Russ, but he's writing an actual chapter on leadership and unique self in his upcoming book. Have we announced that yet, Brett?
We've announced it publicly, but I don't think it's any surprise that, you know, this new iteration of what I've always written and taught about, which is life purpose, would be reflected in a book on integral leadership, right?
Right. And I would say, no surprise at all, I would just do one qualifier and then offer a frame for the leadership conversation, and we can dive in with this frame or without it, which is, the life purpose conversation is still a conversation about separate self, right? That's really important.
Sure. That's the unenlightened life purpose.
That's
right.
That's right.
Right.
So in other words, that's a vocational conversation. It's a you know, somewhat of a purpose conversation, sometimes on deeper levels, but basically it's a separate self conversation, right? And in that separate self conversation, you know, life purpose is essentially a function of your conditioning. And the best you can get to when you talk about uniqueness, right, is it's a reflection of your social, psychological, and cultural conditioning. What we're saying in unique self, right, is of course something radically different. We're saying that actually, when you move beyond separate self, you realize yourself as true self, you move from the personal to the impersonal. When you actually go deeper, you realize that's not the end of the story. The move from separate self to true self, from personal to impersonal, is actually not the goal. That the impersonal or the true self, right, is an awakened realization that's a step on the path. That when you actually drop in deeper, when you awaken more deeply, you realize that there actually is no true self any place in the manifest world, that every true self is unique self, and that actually essence, right, lives in you in an utterly unique way, unlike that it lives in any other person, and so that therefore, and the result is dramatic, therefore your life purpose is not a function of your conditioning. Your life purpose births you. You're born with your perspective, right? You're born to respond to that strange attractor, to that omega point that invites you, right, to fulfill your life purpose. And it actually confronts a person with a kind of, I wouldn't call it a purely objective measure, but it means you can't get lost in relativism. You can't say, well, I'm just going to do what I do. You know, I can pick anything I want to do. Actually, no. Actually, you have a unique perspective. You have a unique set of gifts that emerge from that perspective. You have a unique set of gorgeous obligations that emerge from the fact that you incarnate the love intelligence and love beauty in the cosmos uniquely. So I would just kind of respectfully and lovingly, and Brett and I have had the delight to talk about this many times, say that unique self is not an iteration of the life purpose conversation. It actually evolves the conversation, mm-hmm. because the move from taking it to unenlightened to actually it's an enlightenment conversation, you know, kind of changes the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a kind of, you know, a suggestion there. And then the second thing, and then I'm done, which is, and then, you know, over to you, Sir Russ, is it seems like in the leadership conversation, you know, the one of the weaker links, there's a lot about leadership from the lower left quadrant perspective. There's a lot about the actions the leader needs to take, and, you know, from the upper right perspective. There's a lot about, you know, the leader creating systems. You know, the appropriate system. So Dave Logan's book, we just did a dialogue with Dave, right, is about what is the what are the lower right systems, right, and the lower left culture, right, that enables, you know, tribal leadership, you know, for example. And that's it. That's his conversation. And in a certain sense, what Unique Self says is that we really have got to fill in, we got to fill in the upper left in a big way. And that actually the upper left experience and understanding of the leader's experience of their own unique self, the leader's experience of their creativity, right, the leader's experience of, right, their entire, you know, personhood, right, in the upper left, right, actually dramatically affects leadership. And that's actually, in some sense, the understated quadrant, right, in a leadership conversation. And that actually the upper left needs to be given much, much more ground, because it's through the prism of the upper left, right? Not that the other quadrants disappear, they don't at all. The quadrants tetra arise, as we know. But that the upper left has been dramatically understated in the leadership conversation, and core to the upper left, right, is this unique self conversation, right? That a leader is someone who's actually able to comfortably, naturally, right, you know, appropriately, skillfully inhabit their unique self as a kind of desideratum of leadership, and that when a leader is not inhabiting their unique self, it's actually felt by the entire system, right? And the system begins in the different ways that it can to deconstruct. So that's the proposition I would love to offer, you know, into the conversation, you know, and see where that goes. Is that a fair beginning, friends?
Oh, I think it's a rich beginning. They're on a couple of levels. It helps to point toward ways that I think we both appreciate, or at least I appreciate your work, Mark, as well as tend to think differently than what I was hearing. And I'm reminded of the work of Lara Boroditsky, who's a professor at Stanford, who's been doing research on languages from around the world, in China and Greece and Chile and Indonesia, Russia, Aboriginal Australia. And the kind of conclusions they're coming to from the studies they're doing of people that speak different languages is that they think differently based even on flukes of grammar and the choices of words. I remember one example she gave in a article she wrote, where people who speak languages that do not have compass directions like north, south, east, and west, when they're sitting facing north, they arrange past to present from the right to left. And when they're sitting south, they arrange past to present from left to right. And so language, to use one of your terms, is a uniquely human gift. And it's central to our experience. It's our meaning-making. It's our sense-making around whatever the topic is that we're going to be talking about. In this case, unique self and leadership. And one of the things that I was struck by as I was looking through some of the videos on your Unique Self website for the second time is how many times you use the word unique, and then how many different applications of the concept of unique self or nuances of that emerge from what you have to say.
Mm.
Well, I have a, I guess it's a kind of challenge to all of us in our use of language. Brett was even alluding to this, I think, in his comments earlier, is that when you look at the way people talk about a phenomenon like leadership, you see words like leading, leader, and leadership all being used interchangeably. There are over 1,500 definitions of leadership in the U.S., in the literature. There are over 46 theories of leadership. So basically what that tells us is that we've got a very rich topic about which there is a wide variety of perspectives on that topic. And so I think one of the things that we are almost called to do, whether we're talking about the interiority of the individual or the cultures, the collective, if you will, worldviews and interiorities of the individuals in a system or what have you, is that we need to become far more careful and conscious about how we use language. Because, for example, with the concepts related to leadership, if you read the literature on leadership, quite a bit of the time, you don't know what they mean by that term. And in the way you were talking about it just now, and raising the upper level to a position of prominence, because it has been neglected in much of the literature and the study of leadership, although there's lots of material that relate to it, it suggests to us that we need to turn it more into a both and. We need to understand the upper left in relation to the other quadrants of the map, or whatever dimensions of the map we're going to use. I think it's also important for us to understand that if we're going to be talking about an individual, we're not just talking about their spiritual life or their emotional life or their cognitive life, but we're talking about all those different dimensions, just as Ken has pointed out, and in a perspective that on lines of development that I think is very important. So when we talk about unique self, we need to attend to the symphony of lines that comprise that unique self. And if we're talking about performing effectively in the role of a leader, we need to attend to the symphony of lines that are part of that. And so the language I propose is that leader is a role, just as Brett suggested a moment ago, and a role is a set of expectations that we have of ourselves or others have of anyone who steps into a position of fostering some sort of change development effort. If it's a role and it's a set of expectations, then there is no one who is a leader. And our persistence in talking about individuals as leaders is simply, from my point of view, an effort to sustain the hero archetype and to see people who step into that role, no matter how briefly, as heroes, without taking into consideration that there is the upper left, the upper right, the lower left, and the lower right, the culture, the systems, the processes, the technologies, and so on, that are comprising that leadership event, that leadership episode. And so we need to then think about what individuals do, because when we're talking about the unique self, we're talking about individuals. And what individuals do when they step into the leader role, if they're being effective, is they're leading. They are not leaders, they are leading. And in the movie of that system, they are leading very briefly. So I'll stop there and see what I've triggered for you, Mark.
Let me ask a question. That's all just wonderful and rich, and I want to try and feel with you which way to walk in. So if I would ask you kind of to succinctly state what has changed in the notion of leadership, you know, in the last, 20 years, what's new, what's changed, what's emerged, and how does the unique self, you know, kind of, you know, relate to that, you know, in a direct way, you know? And so it's a question, which is a real question, has a question mark at the end of it, but let me just take a very short stab at it, you know, because I think it relates to a couple of things that you said, which is, in a certain sense, it used to be that the leader was, as you called it, the hero archetype, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the leader was kind of the heroic archetype who was almost, Russ, of a different essential soul quality, if I could use those words, than anyone else, right? You know, people would talk about a born leader. You know, it was a different quality of being. And I think that one of the things that the leadership literature has begun to try and say is that it's actually not about the soul quality of a leader, but it's about developed capacities. Right? The leadership conversation has sought to, you know, really identify what are the capacities that a leader can develop in order to become a leader. And that's a big shift. I just want to notice that. That's a big shift. And that is part of a larger movement, which is implicit and unstated, which is about the democratization of leadership, right? The democratization of greatness. That actually leadership is something that we can train, right? Leadership is something that can be elicited. And that actually in potentia, in potential, you know, every human being is a leader. So, for example, I'll just give you a good example. Have you seen the book by, a new member of the World Spirituality Council, lovely man named, he's a really, really great guy, Richard Barrett. Right, Richard's writing a lot in leadership these days, and he has the Barrett Index that's been used in companies a lot, and he's actually doing a three-part dialogue with us on, you know, on unique self and leadership. So in his book, The New Leadership Paradigm, you know, yeah, okay, great. So in his book, The New Leadership Paradigm, you know, Richard spends, you know, I don't know, you know, the first third of the book, you know, talking about what he calls self-leadership, right? And self-leadership is really about being a human being, right? And then he extrapolates, you know, from these principles of self-leadership to what it means to lead an organization, to lead a company. And I think, you know, to you and to our brother Brett, you know, I think there's kind of two trends I'm trying to point to in the literature. One is the movement against the notion of leadership being a kind of intrinsic, born soul quality to capacities that can be developed, movement one. And then movement two, that movement is based on a desire to democratize leadership, which has both a positive and negative dimension. That's what I want to now add in. The positive dimension is that democratization is a positive thing, right? You know, it expands the notion of leadership from those living on Olympus. You know, Olympus falls, you know, and we all become the gods. You know, it's part of that same movement that says that not only Jesus could participate in his divinity, but that actually, as the Gospel of Thomas says, split a rock and I'm there, right, that we can all participate, you know, in our divinity. The negative is that there's actually a rejection, a kind of a spurious and undiscerning rejection of hierarchies. Right? There's a spurious and undiscerning rejection of hierarchies, and that we actually have a hard time letting people lead. No one actually wants, the tribe actually doesn't want there to be a leader, right? The tribe actually doesn't want there to be a leader, and so the tribe therefore kills leaders. And one of the ways we've done this, and here's the last piece of this kind of flow of argument that, you know, I think, you know, dances with what you said, and one thing I wanted to share tonight, is that therefore we kill leaders. We kill leaders today in a way that we never did before, right? You know, the contemporary notion of scandal. Right, you know, what Reich called the murder of Christ, but he's not talking about Christ, he's talking about the leader, the person who has life force, that we don't want the leader to emerge, and so we actually look for their flaws and we look to bring them down because there's a kind of utter rejection of the implicit hierarchy that creates the leader. So those are a series of thoughts that kind of dance into, I hope, you know, the considerations you put on the table, and so I'm tossing the ball back to you. How does that sound, Russ?
Oh, very rich. I'm going to start with the last thing because
please.
I'm reminded that I'm kind of getting to be an old guy. I graduated from high school in 1954, and in my senior yearbook, I had a graduating class of seven, so each of us had a full page in the yearbook, and so they had quotes for each person, and presumably these were things that the individual had said. And mine, I suspect I must have stolen from W.C. Fields or somebody else, who was the cowboy comedian. I'm blanking on his name. In any case, Will Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
The quote was, it was politicians. Politicians, we swear them in and we cuss them out.
Mm.
Now, that was 1954. That's over 50 years ago. So the phenomena that you're talking about bringing people into leader roles and then killing them, quote-unquote, is not new. I mean, this is something that's It's been around for centuries.
I want to make a short suggestion. I'll completely give it back to you. I just want to suggest that there's an. I think you're absolutely right. The archetype's been around, but there's a deep intensification of it, right? That comes with the emergence of the green meme. It's a very deep.
That's a worthy argument, and I'm not quite going to go there yet.
Got you. I'm sitting back and listening.
Okay. The reason, at least in the literature and in my own thinking, why what you refer to as a democratization of leadership, which means, I will translate that not in unique self terms, but in terms of the kinds of phenomena human complex systems are faced with these days, is that the demands for effective leading are variable, and they shift and they change with the changing life conditions of the system of which we're a part. As a consequence, we cannot rely, given the level of complexity, we cannot rely on the heroic individual except under most unusual circumstances. I am mm-hmm. not trying to suggest there's never a moment that is appropriate for heroism, because I believe there certainly is. But it is an episode. It is a moment. It is a short-lived period in the life of the system. There are other kinds and situations where people need to step into leader roles that have quite a different set of expectations on them. And if this is true, then we're not training leaders, we're not developing leaders, we're developing unique selves, if you will. We're developing individuals who are potentially prepared to be effective stepping into those roles on those wide variety of conditions. So the democratization of leadership is not something that is ideological primarily, although Green might want to own it. The democratization of leadership has its roots in the complexity of Orange and the needs of individuals who wish to, who aspire to greatness in the sense of creating something special or achieving something significant in the world, and recognize with the increasing complexity that they can't do it alone. And so we need different structures, different ways of thinking about how we form our relationships. Sometimes hierarchy is exactly the right way to do it, sometimes not. For example, during the Vietnam War, there was a military unit that when they were in the field, there was no questioning the hierarchy. The military command system prevailed. But when they were out of the field in R&R, they worked with a participatory democratic system in developing their organization, if you will, themselves and their organization. So we are faced with that kind of complexity and different demands at different times on all of us. I hope that at least feeds some of the things that you're
hoping. Yeah, completely. So let's pick up exactly here, okay? So we've put an idea in play, which we're talking about the democratization of leadership. And I think this is key to the conversation, so I want to really stay with this. And this is a subset of a kind of a larger idea that at least, you know, I've tried to talk about, you know, in the Radical Kabbalah book that you published so beautifully, you know, which was the democratization of enlightenment, which we talk about in those books there.
It is beautiful.
I mean, you guys did such a great job. Even a bad book would have looked good. But no, thank God. The book is wonderful, and we're looking forward to share it with the world when we're ready to take that step. So there's the democratization of enlightenment, and Brett, you and I have talked about this in so many dialogues in the last, I don't know, 3-4 months, 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a major theme. And the democratization of enlightenment, right, is the enlightenment conversation way of talking about what I might call the democratization of greatness. Right, and the democratization of greatness, you know, is a kind of broader way to say it. It takes out of the specific enlightenment conversation. But if you really understand that greatness is about waking up, then, of course, the conversations move together, which brings us to the democratization of leadership. And what it really says is that leadership, right, is no longer what it used to be, but that's interpreted, right, in one way by orange, as you point out, Russ, and another way by green, and another way by second tier. That's what I'm going to look at. And it's, what does the democratization of leadership look like at orange? What does it look like at green? And what does it look like at second tier? And we're actually creating new thought, you know, as we go. So this is a breakthrough moment for all of us together, I hope. It's exciting. So the level of orange, right, it's functional and utilitarian, right? You know, better is the two than the one. You know, orange says there's problems to be solved. You know, we need collaboration. You know, we need a kind of, you know, a deeper way of exchanging. The top-down model doesn't work. You know, we need full quality management. You know, however that story's told, right? But it requires the empowering of people up and down the line, right? So there's an orange problem which is functional, right, and creative, and which is answered by a kind of new structural models of, you know, empowered management and empowered, you know, employee, you know, in any one of the systems, right, that actually realize that you've got to catch the problem, you know, at its core and empower everyone's, you know, creativity all through the system, democratization of leadership, right, as a kind of functional, utilitarian, orange level process. That's one. Green takes the democratization of leadership and says, well, green's not moved by orange problems. You know, green is often dissociated. You know, unhealthy green is dissociated from orange. But green says, actually, no one can stand out. All right, green says, you know, the tall poppy syndrome. Right, green says, you know, if you're trying to stand out, you know, then that there's something wrong with you because, you know, everyone's in some sense equal, egalitarian. You know, all voices are, you know, are, you need to co-participate. You know, if we need to have a long meeting, you know, for 17 hours in which everyone gets to express their perspective, well, that's what we'll do because the process in which everyone feels honored, you know, is more important ultimately than the result, you know, which is exactly why, you know, my friend John Mackey started Whole Foods because he was part of a food co-op in Austin. And he said it was so difficult to function in because actually, you know, there was this kind of egalitarian system, which of course covertly was hiding all sorts of power structures like it always does, you know, and so that's green. So green's notion of the democratization of leadership is a function of green's values, right? It's a function of green's values, which actually are anti-unique self, right, in some real way, right? Because, you know, uniqueness just seems too close to hierarchy, right, to green, and uniqueness allows for possible hierarchy, so green rejects that as a possibility. Okay, so that's green. Second tier, takes a whole different approach. Second tier is based on unique self. Unique self is a spontaneously expresses itself as an actual structure stage of consciousness for the first time, you know, as Don and I talked about, not in this last dialogue, but in an earlier conversation, and as I've talked about with Suzanne Cook-Greuter and, you know, any number of other developmentalists, you know, at second tier, unique self appears as a spontaneous structure, right, as a spontaneous natural structure. You don't deduce uniqueness. You have a natural experience of uniqueness. That's the distinction. A uniqueness becomes a first-person spontaneous expression as opposed to a deduction, which is a key shift, right? And so then the democratization of leadership takes an entirely different, you know, color and cast and, you know, texture. Democratization of leadership is the realization that actually every human being is in some sense a unique leader in their system, right? And it also allows for, you know, two other things. It allows for, a hierarchy of leadership, right, because the hierarchy is created because uniqueness essentially implies different qualities, right, and there might be a requirement for these particular qualities to be in leadership in a hierarchical level, right, to make the whole thing function. So we get over in second tier our anti-hierarchical position, right, and unique self is one of the psychoactive structures that allows us to do that, right, and, you know, unique self implies, right, self-leadership. You know, finally, the last point is that what happens at this second tier level, right, in which unique self actually activates this notion of self-leadership, is you create the possibility of an evolutionary we space. Because, you know, at orange, you can't really create a genuine evolutionary we space or a genuine collective intelligence, if we'll use that word, which is more common in the corporate leadership world today. You can't create a genuine collective intelligence because there's too much egoic butting. There's separate selves. At best, they can create a win-win. They can collaborate. They can learn how to, you know, integrate different opinions. But it's really hard to create a genuine collective intelligence emerging from the room because there's just too much separation. You know, at green, It's hard to create a collective intelligence because everyone's agreeing, right? And or everyone's agreeing to disagree, but there's no sense that we can all actually come together. No one's willing to give up their position, or no one's willing to hold their position, one of the two, right? But there's no sense of actually creating this collective intelligence. Right? Very, very hard to do. It's multicultural. Everyone's holding their perspective. It's almost impossible to integrate. But at second tier, you know, beginning in Dawn system with yellow and in the, you know, current integral colors with whatever it is, you know, indigo,
teal.
Et cetera.
Teal.
Sorry, teal than indigo. Thanks. Right? Thanks, guys. Got to track these colors, man. but, you know, then genuine collective intelligence can emerge because collective intelligence is always the function of unique self. Only unique self can create an evolutionary we community. Separate self can't create a genuine community, a genuine collective intelligence. True self can't because the total number of true selves is one. There's only one. There is no community, right? So it's actually only unique self that actually fosters collective intelligence, and collective intelligence is by itself a new modality of leadership, right? And so we actually see that unique self therefore changes the game in utterly essential ways, right, in our experience of leadership. That's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting and it's aspirational, and not an aspiration to be ignored. I think that if we are going to focus our attention on the possibilities and the potentials of development, and the unique self is a wonderful way of understanding that, I think you're spot on. I think one of the things that occurs to me is, As I listen to the notion of the we space, I'm reminded mm-hmm. of an article that will be published in the June issue of Integral Leadership Review, in which an individual who has been working with a coffee cooperative in New Guinea for many years, I think he worked there for about 7 years, one of the New Guinea natives who was in a position of authority stole a lot of money, and he describes in this article the meeting of the tribal leaders, the village leaders, actually. He doesn't use the word tribe, the village leaders, that went on for many, 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 many hours. It would make John Mackey's Green Experience pale by comparison. and yet what's fascinating about the description is the way the different colors show up. And, you know, Don likes to say the spiral is within. So that when we're talking about the we space, there is an earlier version in our development that helps us recognize we space when we're in it, and that's in the purple space. And so all of these exist at the same time. From an aspirational point of view, yes, let's develop, learn, grow, get into ourselves more deeply, into our collective more deeply, into second tier, and recognize that whether it's John Mackey's organization or that collection of villagers in New Guinea or the group in this conversation, that there is a great diversity of selves being brought to this in terms of how the symphony of colors, the panoply of colors, resonates and vibrates with the different kinds of things we're talking about. And so I don't think I'm in any way disagreeing with what you said, Mark. I would raise one question, and that has to do with the potential question that you raised, that everyone has the potential for realizing their unique self, perhaps. Mike Jay, who was one of my teachers at one point in my life, calls that blank slate thinking. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing. I'm saying that's a warning sign, that there are not just the aspects of the individual, but the aspects of the life conditions that dance together to help to create and realize or not realize the kinds of potentials we're talking about. And as a consequence, if we're going to shift from talking about this aspirationally to talking about this in terms of how we embrace the world and realize our unique selves and realize the potentials that others are bringing into the system, that we are going to not assume that everyone is going to be able to realize the kinds of potentials that your work is about.
I think that's right. Is this a good pause, Russ?
It is my pause. Yes.
Okay. I was just, you know, in dialogues, you gotta, you know, you, sometimes you're dialing with someone, and if you know, if you stop to take a breath, they jump in. So I want to tell you now. I want to discern between a breath and a genuine pause.
Go with both feet, Mark.
So I think you're right. In other words, I think I actually agree with everything you said, but I want to pick up, and as I think actually we're, it's a very lovely dance because we're picking up in different dimensions of the same conversation, and I hope moving the conversation forward, you know, in terms of what's possible, what's not possible in terms of leadership, right? But, you know, you point out that not everyone's going to realize, you know, their unique self. Right? That not everyone's going to actually have that level of awakening.
At least not at second tier.
Not at second tier, right? I understand. Well, I mean, in the same sense that not everyone's going to achieve second tier. And that's
right.
Absolutely true. You know, and no but an and the myths that we tell matter.
Yes.
Right? The myths that we tell matter, you know? You know, the myths
like
that we tell...
Yeah, just like
the
myths of leadership.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, that's where this conversation, right, really, really, really matters right now. You know, it matters in so many ways. But here, what's at stake is, what's the myth of leadership? And the myth of leadership, right, is a strange attractor. It's an omega point, right? It calls forward. You know, we've called forward generations of young men, you know, based on myths of a particular kind of heroic leadership and sacrifice. And that myth is valid, by the way. I mean, that's an important myth. We need to transcend and include it. That's an incredibly important dimension, you know, of the myth. You know, and we now need to call forth, you know, new generations of men and women, obviously, right, to a different notion of leadership, right? And the different notion of leadership is that you are a leader, and that the evolutionary scales, right, are hanging in balance, and that they're lined up 50-50 on each side, and that your very next action is going to tip the scale one way or the other, right? That sense of taking evolutionary responsibility, of living in an evolutionary context, right, and actually realizing that I'm awakening to my evolutionary unique self, that the evolutionary impulse that lives alive and awake in me is not impersonal. It's not an impersonal process. It's actually utterly unique. It's irreducibly unique that lives in me, and that I have the ability to be the engine of evolutionary unfolding, right, in a way that no one else in the world that ever was, is, or will be, can do. And I can give a gift to all of reality. And when I realize actually the kind of butterfly effect notions that are playing in physics that just speak of the integration of everything, that everything's so profoundly connected, right, that the notion of separation, right, you know, is an illusion on so many different levels, right, and that my actions have such impact, and that I used to think that if I was living by myself in Nepal, you know, in some village, I'm just living my life. You know, and these spiritual teachers were making these kind of strange claims about interconnectivity, right? Now interconnectivity, right, becomes a kind of given, a sociological, you know, anthropological, you know, political, you know, virtual, you know, physical given. And so actually we begin to realize in this real way that the very next thing I do matters. And that, you know, this notion, well, it's your life, do what you want with it. Well, it's actually not. We're all part of the same great life, right? And that we actually have an obligation and a responsibility to respond in the unique ways we can, and a joy, right? That's the corollary, right, of living that sense of being utterly needed, and having an utterly unique expression, right, that actually, you know, shifts the entire symphony. I want to give you an image, and then I'll finish this thought and throw it right back at you. You know, at a recent firm, recent gathering of Booz Allen, and we're talking in the leadership context here, which is, of course, one of, you know, I'm sure both you and Brett, I'm sure you're familiar with the firm. It's one of the leading consulting firms, you know, in America today, and they really, really have done great work in leadership. So what they did is they actually brought a conductor in, you know, to speak to kind of their top 1,000, you know, kind of leadership consultants. And what the conductor did is, and someone who was there just recently told me about this, Tom Goddard, who was one of the founders of the Integral Institute. He's on our board, and he's working on developing a unique self-process at Shalom Mountain, which is one of our, you know, World Spirituality affiliate kind of sister, you know, programs, the Wisdom School there. So he said that what they did is the conductor played this gorgeous piece of symphonic music. Then they took out of the symphony one, like, little instrument, little piece, you know, and he played it again. And, like, sounded, like, you know, completely differently, you know. And then, you know, they put the piece back in, and it sounded completely differently again, right? And, of course, the point was very powerful, right? You know, when it's missing, it's different, and although it seems inconsequential, right, because what they did is they had the instrument play its note by itself as well. And it just seemed to people utterly inconsequential. And then when they put the piece back in, everybody completely heard the difference. It was like, wow. So that's where we are today. I mean, I think, Russ, this is an awakened realization. We didn't really realize this 100 years ago. We didn't really get, right, this notion that, you know, everything hangs in the balance. That I actually affect everything in some way, that there's a trickle-down, you know, positive, you know, influential and negative insidious effect of everything that I do, and that I'm empowered, right, and to live awake and alive as an evolutionary unique self, right, and realize that irreducible uniqueness that I have in the game, and to experience myself as a leader, right, and to kind of, you know, not in a way that undermines other hierarchies of leadership, but that I'm never just a follower anymore. We can't afford to have followers. Now, will this all happen? So you say, well, not everyone's going to get to second tier. You're absolutely right. What I'm suggesting is that we need to create this as the new myth of leadership, because the myth is the strange attractor. It's the omega point. So that's how I would dance with that. And, you know, tell me if that resonates or if that you know, seems completely off.
Well, I think I certainly empathize with the message. The challenge I have, and it starts almost with your very first sentence about the individual.
Please.
You are a leader. Well, you are a leader, which is a role. You step into a leader role. You are a follower also at times. You are a father. You are a brother. You are a sister. You are a mother. You know, there are all these different kinds of roles that we fill in our lives.
Right.
And we can engage in leading actually through all of those different kinds of roles. So I think
yeah.
that's where we start to touch base with each other.
Yeah.
But for me, when we're talking about development, when we're talking about people realizing a place in the world, realizing how they are manifesting themselves in ways that are significant to them, then we talk about developing individuals as unique selves, as having the capacity to see the kind of systemic complexity that you were referring to earlier, to see that it's connected, to see that we do not exist in isolation, we do not take action in isolation, we do not give voice to what's important to us in isolation. We are not the tree falling in a forest with no one to hear. With over six, what is it? It's how many billion people in the world? I know it's more than six. it's hard to say anything and not be heard. So
right.
in any case, the point being is that the myth is fine. I was in a dialogue with some friends of ours who worked with the Center of Creative Leadership late last week, and they don't anymore, but they've continued to do work on values. And I know being value-driven is an aspect of the unique self that I think you would speak
yeah.
to. And the whole piece around values is so relevant to unique self and so relevant to how we seek to influence and engage. And that is an individual thing, it is a unique self thing, and it is a collective thing, all connected together. And so that brings us to a level of complexity that's hard to parse. And so if we're going to grow and develop, we're going to do it as individuals, and we're going to do it collectively.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, maybe a kind of towards a closing thought, I think we're kind of coming to that time. You talk about values-driven leadership, you know, which is a great phrase. Richard uses it a lot as well. Richard Barrett, we could talk about, as opposed to kind of the purpose-driven life, you know, the values-driven life, you know, or, you know, those, of course, relate to each other in a real way. So let's just try and parse for a second, what is the relationship between unique self and values? I mean, that's actually a really, really important question. And I think, if I can kind of just take a crack at it and then give it to you, and Brett, maybe you'll have after us some closing, you know, comments. Values are generic by their very nature, right? In other words, they are, you know, a broad agreement around things that we find valuable, compassion, you know, justice, you know, goodness, eros. You know, well, eros is probably not exactly a value, depending if you know how you read eros, but eros could be a value, and Plato was certainly a value. So those are values, right? And the nature of values is they sometimes tend to efface the individual. That's what's so interesting about them, right? And it's, the values become, you know, the center of the conversation, and we serve the values, and that's good. We should serve the values because the ego needs to suspend itself, right, and bow at the altar of values. And that's a big deal. So that's why values are so important, because I want a values-driven life as opposed to an ego-driven life, and I'm driven by this higher sense of purpose, this higher sense of alignment with values that have actual value. That's what we're saying about them. They have value, right? They're precious in and of themselves. So what does unique self add to that conversation, right, to the values conversation? So what unique self adds is, I think, two things. One is that there are not just values. There's the values and the unique constellation of values that I'm called to incarnate in the world, right? So my unique self is a unique constellation of values, just like unique self is a unique constellation of masculine and feminine. You know, no two hermaphrodites are the same. So there's no value constellation that's precisely the same. And actually, right, if we can take situational ethics and move it from green to second tier, right, there's actually always a situation at play. There's always a situational ethic. There's always an irreducibly new moment, which is unique. Because uniqueness applies not only to person, but to time. And that unique moment has a new revelation. And in a sense, the two volumes, Radical Kabbalah Rus, are really all about this. That actually every moment invites the creation of a new value. And it's the intersection of the unique self with his or her unique constellation of values, right, together with the unique moment in time that create evolutionary creativity. That create higher and higher levels of insight, higher and higher levels of consciousness, higher and higher levels of value. And then in some sense, and we're covering some big ground here, I mean, it's exciting. In some sense, you know, in a recent dialogue with our colleague and wonderful friend Ken, you know, we did a series of five unique self for six unique self dialogues. We kind of came up with a kind of new formulation, which is that you can really understand evolution as the evolution, right, of uniqueness and creativity, right, animated by eros, right? In other words, the evolution of reality, we usually talk about the evolution of complexity, which is the simple evolutionary understanding, and then we add a kind of Deschardin moment that the interior of complexity is consciousness, so it's the evolution of consciousness. But then what we're kind of adding to it is that actually it's the evolution of uniqueness. That actually, right, in the progressive unfolding of evolution, we get more and more unique, and there's more and more unique constellations of values, right, which is, you know, evidenced in many of the quadrants. You know, it used to be, you know, there was ABC, NBC, and CBS. You watched one of those, you know, on NBC you saw that peacock that always came up, you know, on ABC, that's what it was, and then you had, like, you know, one UHF, you know, one educational TV channel, and that was the end of the story. You know, now there's the sense I'm going to create my own music. You know, I'm going to kind of podcast and create, you know, exactly what I want to hear. There's this enormous movement to narrowcasting, you know, which has, it has deleterious dimensions, but it's part of a general, you know, kind of implicit recognition of this unique constellation, this unique emergence, right, of an I that now needs to be reconnected with the greater I, with the greater community. So I think that this kind of puts some new light on kind of where we're going, you know, and what can emerge in a really, you know, really, you know, potentially important way.
Yeah, I think you've expressed the potentiality of this situation very well. And
yeah.
And I'm almost ready to leave it there and see what Brett has to say.
Absolutely. Good plan.
Well, that's very, very kind of you, gentlemen, to ask me my perspective. What I loved about this dialogue tonight is really breaking some new ground and going into some new areas that I haven't heard discussed often, if not at all. The one thing that's one of the big takeaways for me from the book, from Unique Self, the model, and from my own kind of personal experience as a leader, just as a human being, and also in being a coach for leaders for 20 years now, is that Unique Self articulates and helps me understand an experience I've had in my life but didn't have a way to articulate it, and it really helps me understand when I'm working with leaders to help them, and it gives me a map to help me draw that out. And the experience I'm talking about is something that hasn't been mentioned tonight, and that's what I would add, and that's the experience of inspiration, the experience of being called. And this is something that is I've experienced often in my life. This, you know, even before I found Integral, and so on. But this feeling of being called from not from a mind place, or a personality place, or ego place, or a brain place, but some kind of much higher place, a spiritual place, if you will. This sense of calling, this intuition, this inspiration, where you're really called forth and asked to do something. And as I've deepened more realization of true self over the years through practice, and then as I've learned about Unique Self, it's like, oh, that's what it is. It's breaking through, you know, breaking through not only the ego or the mind. It's not something bubbling up. It's something coming down, if you will, that's being called forth, this, and it feels very spiritual. I use the term inspiration. That's the best kind of word that I can use without using religious terms, which I prefer inspiration as a term. But it's not merely true self. It's absolutely calling me and my clients and colleagues forth that have this experience to, based upon our uniqueness, based upon our unique perspective, our wounds, our damage, our gifts, you know, all these things that make us unique. And I think that's, in my experience, Unique Self is just hugely helpful to understand what it means to be called forth, whether that be a role or an action, in whatever style of leadership, whatever context, but that our Unique Self is almost inseparable from giving our best and highest when we lead.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And I think that's a great That's a great place to stop. There's like six more things that kind of come to mind. But
we'll need a series of six more dialogues to unpack all of that. But
it does. But I think we really did, Brett. First off, Brett, thank you so much for. I think that was really just added dimension that was really critical. And you know, we're not making too many big announcements tonight. But Brett and I are working on a project which we call Answering the Call.
Mm.
You know, which is a meme waiting to emerge, which is, you know, one of the articulations of unique self, which will find its way. I think what was really so many things special about this dialogue, I just want to reflect on the last second. We actually broke a lot of really interesting new ground. It's unusual in a dialogue. There's really a lot of new structures that kind of came up. And I think you're right, you know, Russ. In other words, you know, I'm taking a very utopian stand, you know, which is really what you're pointing to. And three or four of you know, I'm taking a stand, but not in the sense of naivete, I hope, but in the sense of the myths that we create, the strange attractors that we set forth, are what are going to call us into the future.
I can hear them calling now.
Awesome. And you know, Integral Leadership Review, you know, oh, my God. You know, I mean, that's you know,
awesome.
That's in this larger community, you know, the forum that's really kind of holding this leading-edge conversation. So a deep bow to you, sir, Russ, and thank you very, very much for all that you do and for the delight of this kind of just great, great conversation.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been fun. Brett, thank you. And Brett and Russ, you know, as Integral Publishers with Keith, you know, deep bow to you. Thank you, everyone, for being with us. Brett, do we want to mention anything about, you know, book and course, anything like that?
Yeah, it was mentioned in the welcome email, but anyone in participating in this dialogue series, a new development is everybody has the opportunity to receive the Awakening Your Unique Self mini course, $100 value, free, and it's an excerpt of the 10-week comprehensive course, which of course is based upon this groundbreaking book, Your Unique Self. So if you registered for this dialogue, you'll receive an email with more information about that.
Fantastic. And I think the course starts April 24th, the actual big course?
Correct.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you, everyone. What a delight.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. We'll say good night until the next series in our ongoing dialogue series. So thanks so much, everyone. Great call. And look forward to being with you again soon.
Thanks,
bye,
Brett.
For now.
Thanks, Brett. Bye, guys.
Thank you all.